It should be automatically recorded. But a lot of them should be. Should we double check? It says recording. I want to thank Kenny and Meredith and Kenny's siblings and their families, the Glucksman and Davis families, for sponsoring this evening's shiur. And the shiur, the learning this evening, will be Le'ili Nishmas Arya Leib Ben Chaim Zev, Kenny's father. And our learning should also bring Zechuyos to affect the complete refuah of Shira Bas Devar Aleya. The Shloshim Yom Kodem series of Shurim is something that's very important in my understanding of what our shul should be doing, what communities should be doing. Moshe Rabbeinu established two distinct rules. One is that on the Yom Tov itself, we study the laws of the Yom Tov to understand the Yom Tov better. We study the various events and readings of the Yom Tov. But then Moshe Rabbeinu also understood that a Yom Tov is only going to have its impact on Klal Yisrael. And a Yom Tov is only going to be fully celebrated if we prepare and get ourselves, get our minds and hearts into the Yom Tov. And for Kodesh Baruch Hu's Yom Tov, it doesn't happen with one day, 2.5 days. It requires 30 days of preparation. That's why I'm very excited that Kenny and Meredith and their families give us the privilege of having Rabbi Penner speak to us this evening. And it would be hard to imagine a person who's better suited to give us an insight and a message that will still resonate with us, I'm sure, 30 days from now. And a person who is so skilled in his presentation, and a person whose thoughts run, Baruch Hashem, deep, and a person who's so passionate about the Klal Yisrael. They see that day in and day out in his handling and planning, handling the smicha program and handling the students in the smicha program, planning for Klal Yisrael. That I'm sure that this evening's presentation will hit the mark and continue to prepare us and be a very important part of the celebration of our Yom Tov. We welcome all of you. We welcome Rabbi Berg, who's in our Zoom room. We recognize Rebbetzin Penner, who's also in our Zoom room. And we thank you for giving us Rabbi Penner, even though he has to cross at least the two bridges before he gets home these days. And thank you very much.
Thank you, Rabbi Neuberger. It's always a pleasure to speak here. It's still intimidating to speak in front of you, but I'm getting used to it. I think speaking here again and again and again to try to address a yard site, a dear friend who needs a refuah shleima, and to deal with Pesach. Very hard to believe that Pesach is coming. I'm not going to try to overemphasize that with this shiur. I don't want this to be the breaking to everybody that Pesach is in fact coming. But as Rabbi Neuberger said, I have a difficult task, which is to talk about something about Pesach that you might still be thinking about when it's Pesach, and especially in Corona land, where every week is a year. So you pretty much have to remember what I'm going to say for 3 years at this point. So that's quite a challenge. But I thank the family, thank the Davises and the Glicksmans and the Yeagers for sponsoring tonight. And what I'm going to do to try to make sure that you can't forget what I'm going to say is not to finish my thought, not to finish the idea, but to leave you hanging. And I'll admit that the reason why I'm going to do that is not just because It happens to be about 3 weeks before Pesach. But because what I'm going to do tonight is to present the beginning of an idea. You see, in baseball, they're starting pitchers and they're closers. To be a closer, you really have to know your stuff. To really nail them down to end the ninth inning, to walk off the mound and say, okay, everybody can go home now, we're done. That's one level. But I see my role more as a starting pitcher, to throw out an idea. And I'm going to throw out an idea tonight that is very unusual. Already from the name of the title of the shiur, you might get a sense that we're going to do something quite different this evening. I love this particular idea, and I'm very excited to be able to share it with you. But I'm far from having figured it out yet, partially because I'm not a developmental psychologist, although I really am fascinated by developmental psychology. And second, because there are lots of pieces that are still going to need to be filled in, even at the end of the shiur. But sometimes you run across something that has so much merit, that is so fascinating, that even if you can't put every single piece into the puzzle, you feel like it's better to present it and ask others to try to put in their pieces, to try to figure it out. So I welcome that. If you have a little piece that you can put together to this puzzle, but sometimes you see you put enough pieces on the puzzle that an image begins to appear and you say, it's got to be going somewhere. So let's try to explore an idea together. I promise you won't be bored by this wild idea, bringing together Torah and developmental psychology. Rosh Mahu Omer. What does the Rosh say at the Seder? So the Rosh says, Maha Avodah Hazos Lachem. Okay, the Rosh says, what is this to you? But last time I met a Rosh, I don't know too many Rishayim who are also very, very quiet with their words. You have to assume if you have a Rosh at the table, he's going to ask more than one question. And I have another question that I could assume someone who's a Rosh would want to ask. You see, we make a really big deal about the fact that God took us out of Egypt. Miracles, unbelievable. He took the Jewish people out of Egypt. We're so lucky. The slavery was terrible. At the Seder, it's not like so terrible. The Seder is a little bit of a cleansed version, unless you bought the right Haggadah with the right pictures. But, you know, we talk a couple of words here and there. Avodas Parah, you know. Really, we know it was a lot worse than that. It was 210 years. How many years was the slavery itself? It was generations of people who were slaves. And we know from what was done to African Americans when they were brought into the country, we have images in our mind now of what it meant to be a slave. But with all due respect, you can imagine that the Jews were treated even worse. What happened to them wasn't by trying to get the kids at the table. Don't sing, you know, oh, it's work, work, work every day and every night. But they weren't singing in Mitzrayim. It was a concentration camp. It was a work camp. People died. Many, many people died. And many, many people were born into it and died as slaves. They never, ever understood anything in life except being born into slavery, living in slavery, and dying, if they were lucky, a natural death as a slave. And I can imagine a Rasha, or many of the Rishonim, as we'll see, could ask the following question. It's really nice that God took us out of Egypt. But has anyone ever asked at the Seder table, isn't he the one that put us there in the first place? It's really special that he took us out. But he put us there. Yes, the Egyptians used their free will. The Egyptians went beyond what they were supposed to do. However, you'll try to explain that idea. But he told Avram Avinu that your kids are going to be strangers in a strange land. Kodesh Baruch Hu seemed to have a tremendous amount to do with the Shibud of Mitzrayim. Not just Yitzias Mitzrayim. So would someone really be a Rasha if they asked at the table, with all due respect, he put us there in the first place? Why don't we talk about that more at the Seder? How do we understand the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us through generations of misery and slavery and death and horror? How do we understand the fact that babies were thrown? I understand the Egyptians did it with their own free will. The Torah doesn't name who the villain is going to be that's going to do this to us. But the very same questions that are asked about a Shoah can be asked about the Shibud in Mitzrayim. Why were we slaves in the first place? Not just what do we have to thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for now that he took us out. It's a reasonable question to ask, and I don't think you're a Rasha if you ask that question. We're going to look tonight at a couple of approaches in the Rishonim and the Achronim as to why we were there in the first place. But then I'd like to suggest a novel idea myself. And I'm curious to hear what you'll think of it. And then we all get to go home, we get to think about what's going to be on the menu for us. Says the Gemara in Adar, the first source on the source sheet. Amar Rabbi Lazar, mipnei ma ne'enash Avram Avinu. The Gemara asks this question. You can't be such a Rasha. Mipnei ma ne'enash Avram Avinu, v'nishtabdu vanav l'mitzrayim, ma'asayim ve'eser shan. What did Avram Avinu do so terrible that he had to live with the knowledge that his great-grandchildren are all going to be slaves in Egypt? And the Jews had to be slaves in Egypt for 210 years. The Gemara asked this. The good news is it asks the Gemara in the Nedarim, but unless you're doing Daf Yomi, you really don't do the Gemara in the Nedarim, so you don't come across this. But Lamaisa, the Gemara asked this question. Why were we slaves in Egypt? What fault did Avram have? Now again, that's right, you see from the very beginning, the Gemara's assumption is ne'enash. It was a punishment. And that's always going to be a very difficult thing for us to accept. We would never want to say that about the Shoah, which happened in our world, in our lifetime. Now we're talking about something much, much, much before. Maybe it's a little easier. The Gemara uses the word ne'enash. Why were they punished? What was this a punishment for? Which raises the question, what could be a punishment? What could one have done that the result would be that hundreds of thousands, that millions of people are going to be slaves for generations? What possibly could be such a sin? Mivnei she'asa angariya b'talmidei chacham. Says Rabbi Lazar, opinion number one, he drafted rabbinic scholars into the army. That's interesting. She'asa angariya b'talmidei chachamim she'nemar v'yorek et chanichav yelidei beiso. He goes to war in the war of the four kings and the five kings. Who does he take? You're all familiar with the Rashi that says it was Eliezer, the Gematria Eliezer. The Pasuk says he took his chanichav, his chanichim. I think that's the word they use in Moshavah, Bnei Akiva, right? The chanichim. But here we understand them to be, what's a Rebbe is a mechanech, mechaneches, is it the students? So Avraham Avinu made the mistake. This in no way reflects on anything having to do with Eretz Yisrael today, but according to the Gemara and the Dharma, he made the mistake. He took the guys out of the Beis Medrash. What were they learning in the Beis Medrash in those days? I don't know. What did they learn full-time in Yeshiva Shem Be'ever? I don't know. But whatever it was, because he took these Talmidim out of the Beis Medrash for a couple of days, that's why his children were enslaved for 210 years. A little hard to accept that. Shmuel Omer, Mipnei Shehifriz Almidoso Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shmuel says it's because he pushed HaKadosh Baruch Hu too hard. He said, "B'ma'ida ki irashena." How do I know that you're going to keep that promise? Okay. You could argue we went a little far. 210 years? We're talking about death. We're talking about concentration camps. Rabbi Yochanan Amar Shehifrish Bnei Adam Milahachnis Tachas Kanfei Hashchina. The third opinion there of the Gemara Nedarmas was at the end of the war, when the king of stone says, Tainli ha-nefesh v'ha-rechush kach loch, I'll take the people, you take the money. What does Avram say? I don't need the money. What should he have said? I'd like the people. What person's going to grow up religious in stone? Big mistake. Big mistake. Custody case, he lost the kids. The kids all grew up in stone. That's why Klal Yisrael are going to be enslaved. It's a very, very difficult Gemara to understand. The Maharal in Buras Hashem cannot accept the Gemara at its simple way. First of all, interestingly, it says, Mipnei Ma'enash Avram Avinu. What exactly was Avram Avinu punished with? Knowing this knowledge, we know that Avram Avinu died at an old age. He died before he saw Esav go off the derech. He died a very old and happy, fulfilled man, as he should have. He didn't really get punished. The kids got punished. But really punished. So the Maharal suggests that it's not so much that they were punished because of this, but something needed to be fixed because of a sin that Avraham Avinu did. Maharal explains beautifully that you can imagine a tall building. If there's a crack, he couldn't imagine this, but if there's a crack on the 35th floor of the building and there's 36 floors, okay, so you got to get it fixed. There's a crack towards the bottom. If there's something fundamentally wrong with the engineering at the bottom of the tower, so the slightest problem could wreak havoc, could be a disaster. The Maharal says that what the Gemara is telling us is not, so to speak, a punishment. How could this be the punishment that was deserved? But it reflected a tiny flaw. Avraham Avinu set the Jewish people in motion. He was responsible for putting them on a path from his time till the end of history. And the tiniest flaw, if you set off on a direction and you're only going 100 feet, if you're a little bit off, it's okay. But if you're going to go for thousands of years, that tiny little bit of challenge, that's going to take you way off course. You're never going to get to where you want to go. That's the Maharal says in Maharal. Not a punishment per se, a correction. A good punishment is something that's meant to teach, not to punish. Now, of course, the Maharal doesn't yet explain how did they benefit from generations in concentration camps. But somehow, says the Maharal, what happened in Mitzrayim was needed to put them back on the right path. Already, a couple of generations after Avram, something, there had to be a cataclysmic event that would put them back on the path. Still very hard to understand. The Yalkut Reuveni says, as others do, that it was a punishment for Mechiras Yosef. Okay, that's a little... Somehow I could, still, but generations of people? The Meshech Chachma says it was a punishment for the Jews themselves assimilating in Egypt. That's sounding a little more. Of course, it wasn't those Jews who suffered, the ones who assimilated in Egypt. It was their children and grandchildren and grandchildren. It's very hard to understand this concept. There's a fascinating idea by the Sephardim. The Sephardim explains that the reason for the original Gzeira, yes, the Egyptians took it too far, they were cruel. Why did the Jews have to be foreigners in a foreign land? The Sephardim says something so brilliant. How many Jews are there when they go down to Egypt? 70 Jews. If you're a family with 70 people, you pretty much got what you need. I can't imagine making Pesach for 70 people. But if you have 70 people, you pretty much got one of everything. If something goes wrong, if the car breaks down, you got to figure there's somebody in the group that's going to be able to fix the car. If you got 70 people in the family, somebody has a recipe for this. Somebody's got that. 70 is a very nice number for a family. But what if you want to turn from a family into a people? What if you want to move beyond being a family and you want to become a people? Well, once you're 3 million people, you're pretty self-sufficient. Can you find a good shidduch? Yeah, 3 million people. It's got to be somebody out there. Is there a division of labor? 3 million people, we're going to figure it out. We could be a self-sufficient people, one of the 3 million. But listen closely. What do you do when you grow to a few thousand people? When you're 70, you're a family. When you're functioning as a family, you can remain separate as a family. But when you're a couple of thousand people, you're not self-sufficient at all. You need everyone around you. Says the Sforno, how could the Jewish people have ever gotten from 70 to 2.5 million? Had they been friends? Had they been assimilated into their society? Had they been in a place that was friendly? There's no way that they would have survived that stage of their development. Impossible. They would have needed those around them too much. How could you take a people and grow them from 70 to 2.5 million when they're ready to be a self-sufficient people? You got to put them in a bubble. The only bubbles that exist in the world are because people hate you. It's hard to find a bubble on an island somewhere. The bubble, says the Sforno, this looked like the worst thing that ever happened to us. They refused to accept it. Yeah, they went too far. But the entire idea of the Xavier that we'll be a strange people in a strange land, says the Sforno, no, wait a minute, this had a purpose. We would not have emerged as a people unless we had this opportunity to be hated, to be separated, unless we were actually enslaved, maybe not killed, enslaved in such a way we wouldn't want to, and no one would want to marry us, no one would want to be part of our group. The Maharal himself and the Abarbanel takes a very similar approach, suggests that it's what we call Yisurin Shel Ahava. I don't know how to explain it. Yisurin Shel Ahava, almost an oxymoron. But the Abarbanel explains that what it means, not so different from the Sforno, and not even so different from what the Maharal had said, explained when it talked about the Avraham Avinu, was that not everything's a punishment. But sometimes you need to go through a certain experience to get from point A to point B. It's painful. It's difficult. But God wants to make sure that we're going to end up in the right place. Yisurin Shel Ahava explains the Abarbanel, Golus Mitzrayim Haisa Mitzad, it's not on your sheet, Mitzad Hatova v'chesed. It wasn't an onesh. God was doing us a favor. Sometimes you got to give somebody tough love if you want to make sure they're going to get to the place that you want. Kedeshi akiru elokuso v'yikavu torasa. Had the Jews not been slaves, they never would have attached themselves to God. They never would have left in the desert to follow him unless they were running away from something. The Maharal explains, the Abarbanel explains, and really, in many ways, all of those we've seen explain it wasn't exactly a punishment. It's very, very hard to understand that this could have been a punishment. This punishment could have been for anything anybody could have done. But it somehow got us to a place that we needed to be. With our human minds, it's very hard to understand how suffering could ever be worth it. We rarely get to a point where we say, ah, thank you for all those difficulties I went through. I get it now. It usually doesn't happen in our lifetime. But God is not looking just at our lifetime. And remember, most of the Jews who were in Egypt never saw Yetzias Mitzrayim. What would any one of us give to be there for Yetzias Mitzrayim? But many people never saw Yetzias Mitzrayim. Would it have been worth it to be a slave for 80 years to live through Kriyas Yamsuf? I would really have liked to have been there, Kriyas Yamsuf. But most of the people didn't get to Kriyas Yamsuf. They never saw the Geula. They never tasted freedom. They just went through the pain. How? How is this experience something the Jewish people needed? What changed in the Jewish people? What could possibly have needed this much time, this much pain? I'd like to suggest something this evening. There's a parak in Yechezkel that was blacklisted by the rabbis. A parak of Yechezkel that was blacklisted by the rabbis. The Gemara talks about whether or not we're allowed to read this as a haftorah, and the answer is it's just too cruel to Klal Yisrael to read in shul on Shabbos morning. It's not right. You got to save some dignity for the Jewish people. The theme of this parak, the 16th parak of Yechezkel, is the fact that the Jews seem to be kafuye tov. Listen closely. They don't understand what it is that God did for them. God does everything for us, and we show no appreciation for him. And that's the theme of this parak. The people are already rebellious by the time of Yechezkel. And he's trying to explain to them, you don't understand. God took you out of Egypt. He brought you from nothing. But listen to these psukim. Umoldo sayech biyom huledes. Right? The yom huledes already appears in the Torah, right? Whose birthday appears in the Torah? Paro. Yom huledes is Paro, right? Umoldo sayech biyom huledes. It's a mashal. Biyom huledes osach. The one that gave birth to you. Lo karas shareich uvamayim lo ruchatz lemishi. The one who gave birth to you, Jewish people, didn't take care of any of your needs. I found you, Jewish people, as a lost child, as an abandoned baby. No one had swaddled you, no one had washed you. The birth took place, and no one took care of you in the moments after your birth. Nobody looked. There was no one else there to do anything for you. You were left after a birth on the side of the road. On your birthday, the day you were born, I found you. Now this pasuk we know. I passed you and I saw you wallowing in your blood. You hear it at the bris, you hear it at the seder. God says, you were born in Egypt. What does this mean? Who was born in Egypt? What does that mean? God found us on the side of the road in Egypt? It means, the pasuk is telling us, that the Jewish people were born in Egypt. You see, we always had Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and they had children and grandchildren, and a lot of people were born beforehand. But something was created at the end of the Shibur. When God stepped in to take us out of Egypt, listen closely, he found us as a baby. That baby's name is the Jewish people. There were people, there were descendants of Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, but we couldn't speak of the fact Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov weren't Jewish in a regular sense. And the fact is, on some level, none of us were Jewish till we got to Har Sinai. But the concept of a Jewish people was born on a roadside in Egypt. And God found us there, and he found us bleeding, and he found us wallowing, he found us disgusting and dirty. The Jewish people were born at Yetzias Mitzrayim. Fascinating Yalkut Shimoni. Oh, he nasai, look at the source sheet. Oh, he nasai, lokim lavo lakachas lo goy mikerev goy. God took us what? We were a goy? Mikarev goy. When God took us out of Egypt, he took us out. What a very interesting image. Doesn't say he took us out of Egypt. He took us out of the Egyptians. He took the Jewish people out of another entity, out of the Egyptian people. Goy mi karev goy. Karev means the inside. Mao goy mi karev goy. Ka adam shehu shomeit esa ubar mimei habehema. A person sticks their hand into a pregnant animal, cuts the umbilical cord, and yanks out the baby. That's what God did for us in Egypt. We were so embedded in the Egyptian world. We were so lost. We were so nameless and faceless in Egypt that he literally reached into Egypt and took out something that didn't exist. We were a fetus. We didn't have an existence. When he reached into Egypt, the Yad Chazakah, when God reached into Egypt and took us out, he yanked out an unborn yet fetus. And he took us out of Egypt. Kach Otzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu is Yisrael Mimitzrayim. Kadosh Baruch Hu calls us his oldest son, B'ni Bechori. B'ni Bechori. Where were we born? If we're the children of God, where were we born? We were born in Egypt. The Jewish people came to be in Egypt. Why did generations of Jews have to die in Egypt? Now you could tell me God could do anything, so that's a ridiculous answer. Nothing needed to happen. God could just snap his fingers and anything could change. But if God wanted the world to run according to somewhat natural means, what was accomplished in 210 years? What was accomplished in 210 years of being slaves, of being people in a strange land? The Rambam, I don't know, I just quoted a few things on the source sheet. The Rambam says in the laws of Avodas Kochavim, listen to these words. He talks about how everything went down and down and down and down, and how we got stuck in Egypt, and how in Egypt we worshiped idols. Everyone except for Shevet Levi, they all worshiped idols. The Ha'ikar Sheshosal Avram, the Iker, the main plant, the thing that had been planted by Avram Avinu, Nebuch, poor Avram Avinu, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov worked so hard to bring up from kids. But it was 210 years in a foreign land. Ve'a'ikr sheshosol Avram ne'ekar was uprooted. Were there still, do we still have Avram Avinu somewhere in our genes? Yes. Do we have Yitzchak and Yaakov in our genes? Somehow we still have them in our genes. Can we look to them to pave the way? I think I spoke about this last year. Here, the three tfilos, the three avos. Can we look at those people to pave the way for how to relate to God? Absolutely. But says the Rambam, you know what happens in 210 years? Everything gets lost. That which was planted by Avram Avinu was uprooted. V'chozrim b'nei Yaakov l'ta'us ha'amim u'te'iyasam. And the Jewish people basically became the Egyptians. They were, you couldn't tell the difference, except the fact that one was the one with the whip and one was the one that was the slave. But in terms of their neshama, in terms of what they had become, 210 years took the last bit of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov out of these people. Why? Perhaps because God wanted to meet us anew when we were leaving Egypt. Perhaps because it's not the same thing to be the children of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov as to be the Jewish people, to be Klal Yisrael. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were wonderful ancestors that we had. But you know what? The time had come for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to establish a relationship not with you and you and you and you and you, not with the great-grandson of Avram and the great-great-grandson of Yitzchak and Yaakov, but to meet a completely new entity, a goy mikarev goy. The Jewish people. For some reason, God wanted to make a pact, not with a bunch of individuals, not even with the children of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but with an entirely new entity that was going to be born after 210 years of everything they had being stamped out of them. Ha'ikar sheshosol Avram ne'akar v'chozim b'nei Yaakov v'tol sa'am. Without the memories of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we never would have made it to Mitzrayim. Without the Shevet Levi, who was effectively the Bechor of Yaakov Avinu, we wouldn't have made it. We wouldn't have, there would have been nothing left. An Ubar, a fetus, is still a little bit different than the mother. It's Mikarev Goy, but it's inside, but it's still a separate entity. The others, their job was to put enough into us that we could remain a Goy, Mikarev Goy. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted the Jewish people to go through an experience such as they would meet God for the first time now as a people. They would meet him as a baby. God wanted to get to know the Jewish people as a new identity, as a new group, Klal Yisrael, with the DNA of the Avos, but a new baby, a new relationship with God, like a baby who would develop a new relationship with a parent. Maybe if we understood how a baby develops a relationship with their parents, how a baby learns to interact with something outside of him or her, maybe there's something that we could understand about the Jewish people and God. Because he didn't just want to meet with us. He didn't have us go undergo some collective amnesia. He specifically meets. You see this in the Medrash. You see this in the Psukim, in the Yehezkel. He wanted to meet us as a baby on the first day they're born. How in the world does a baby figure out how to relate to anybody on the day that it's born? How does it know how to do that? How does it figure that out? HaKadosh Baruch Hu understands that he's very, very hard to get to know. He's invisible. He's unknowable. But he doesn't want us to follow his rules. He wants us to have a relationship with him. How in the world am I supposed to develop a relationship with someone who is unknowable and invisible? Perhaps what HaKadosh Baruch Hu did was give us examples in this world, people we can relate to in this world, so that we could learn to relate to him. In essence, if you think about it, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have created 6 billion worlds and dropped every one of us into a different world to try to develop a relationship with him. But we'd have no idea what a relationship means. We take it for granted as an adult that we know what it means to relate to somebody, to talk to somebody, to trust in somebody. How do we learn that? Because he put us here together. And he put us here as part of a family. How do we learn? I'm so happy to be able to have my father here tonight. How do we learn how to trust in somebody? How do we learn that there's someone who gives us rules and those rules are for our good? HaKadosh Baruch Hu surrounds us with relationships that imitate ways of relating to him. And it's therefore not an accident that he calls us his children. Because what he's telling us is, use the relationships I gave you, understand them, use them, and now you'll understand a little better how to relate to me. HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls us his wife. We're not his wife. But can you really understand what it means to be fully intimate with someone or something outside of this gift called marriage? It doesn't mean you can't have a relationship with God if you're not married. It doesn't mean you can't have a relationship with God if you're not blessed with children. But every single relationship that we have gives us a deeper understanding of what it means to be God and what it means to relate to God. children in particular. Give us an understanding, not of how to relate to God. We'd never call God our child, but certainly helps us a lot to understand how God relates to us. We're that five-year-old who can't understand why God would say no, even though he has a good reason for saying no. It's hard to really appreciate that till you have a five-year-old having a fit in front of you, when what they want would be horrific for them, but they have no way of understanding. The human relationships that we have, which are obviously not limited to just our family members. Why? Because he put all of you there, and he put me here for you. Everyone in the world is here so we can somehow learn to relate in different ways to something outside of us. And if we do enough of those and we do them well, then we can begin to understand how to relate to God. And all of that is because, as we said, God doesn't want us to follow his rules. He does, but he wants us to relate to him. So by having parents and children and siblings and friends, could it be that if we study the way an infant begins to develop relationships, that we can understand the way that this people, who is called an infant, began to relate to God? Could it be that if we understand the challenges that people face as they grow up, dealing with their parents, dealing with their friends, dealing with their peer groups, could that maybe give us insight as to what it meant that we were reborn in Egypt and we met God again as a baby and then we grew up with him? My first foray into developmental psychology was in a course that I got to take with Dr. Moshe Eidensfeld, the blessed memory, still at Englewood. What a genius. It was some honors course. He didn't belong teaching a regular class in Yeshiva College, but he ended up, I was in some honors course where he taught development from birth to three. And I developed a lifelong passion for this idea of development, specifically from birth to three, because it is absolutely ridiculous what happens between birth and three. It doesn't make any sense. If you have the schus to watch a normally developing child, a normally developing infant, even if this year you have to, as a grandparent, watch that over Zoom, it's insane. It's incredible how kids just figure stuff out. How do they start talking? How does that happen? How do you go from being an infant, a newborn, to talking within a year? The challenge is that when it happens normally, we don't even think about it. It doesn't even occur to us that the child has gone through stage after stage after stage after stage to get there. The field of developmental psychology is to try to break down each one of these steps to get from point A to point B and understand all the things that the child has learned in order to be able to get there. Many of you know that my wife and I have a wonderful child named Mattis, who's now 25 years old. And Mattis, from a very young age, struggled with autism, which gave us the chance to watch stages develop over a decade that might have happened over a year. And when you watch someone who isn't wired for language have to develop language, you realize that it's just not something that just happens. Language doesn't just happen. There's so many things you need to understand to go from being a newborn to the first word, Abba, Ima, Baba, whatever the thing is the kid is saying. That's insane what the child, all the steps that the child has gone through. Stages is not a term that's foreign from Yetzias Mitzrayim. The the Pesukim make it very clear that what we call Yetzias Mitzrayim wasn't Yetzias Mitzrayim. It was a series of stages. Piaget. Shiur tonight is really about Erickson. But Piaget was one of the groundbreaking psychologists in terms of language development. You've all heard about Piaget. You either took a 12th grade class or psychology 101 or an AP or something like that. What did Piaget say? Piaget spoke about the different things you have to accomplish to say your first word. One of the things Piaget talks about is something called object permanence. What is object permanence? Object permanence is a fairly simple thing if you know what it is. It's the kind of thing that once you know what it is, it's obvious, but it's so not obvious to a little kid. How could you label something if you don't know that it exists? You see, when a little baby sees Ima, they smile, but then Ima goes away. They may cry, but they're not crying because Ima went away. They're crying because this thing that they liked in front of them is no longer in front of them. A child has absolutely no way of knowing that you exist when you leave their range of vision. Why should they know you exist? You speak to the child, that's very nice. You disappear. As far as the child knows, you cease to exist. Where does this idea come from that, oh, they must have gone somewhere? That's called object permanence. You have to learn that. It's incredible that a child's able to learn that when they're 6 months old. But they learn that you don't disappear. You just go somewhere else. How could you label something? How could you start to really use language unless you know the thing exists? It's not just an experience that I have. The thing exists. It's a ball. It's a ball, whether I'm looking at it or it's over there. It's a thing. It's a ball. Many of the Mefarshim talk about the fact that the word Pesach is a contraction of the words Peh and Sach, a mouth that started to talk. As Yosher Moshe of Israel. Why could the Jewish people not really talk until they left Mitzrayim? Because I believe that they didn't have what I would call not object permanence, but God permanence. To praise God takes so many steps of developmental psychology. To recognize that there is a God, to recognize that he's consistent, to recognize that even if I don't see him today, he's still there. The Jewish people had to learn all of these things. They were babies. Pesach, the holiday we're about to come up to, is described as developmental language. It's the development of the ability to speak to God. They go through stages. We are so unfair to the Jewish people when we read the Chumash. We recently read Parshas B'Shalach. So Parshas B'Shalach is where the Jews just can't, they keep complaining, right? They complain at the sea, right? They're too weak. They're not, God says, I wish I could take them this direction, but I can't take them this direction because they're going to freak out if I take them to the shore. And then they come and then there's no water. The water is bitter. So the people freak out. The people get all upset. What's going on? We're going to die. And then there's no food. They run out of food. So they say, oh my God, the whole world is going to end. We're going to die. Thing after thing after thing. They're standing at the sea. The Egyptians are coming. The Jewish people say, this is the end. If you notice, it's fascinating. In Parshas B'Shalach, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not get angry at the Jewish people as many times as they complain. Because they are not supposed to know this. When does he get mad at them? When they complain about water at the end of the parsha? A second time. Once they complain about water a second time by the rock, then God says, wait a minute, we already covered this last week in school. You know I can do water. Yeah, I sweetened the water last time. Now I got to make the water, but you know I'm good with water. Now I'm upset, comes a mullet. The story of Parshas B'Shalach with the Jewish people growing up. We always can't believe, how could the Jewish people not recognize God? You know what? They were kids. Why were they supposed to rely on God? Who told them you could rely on God? Yeah, they saw 10 plagues. You know what the 10 plagues told them? That God is good at punishing people. That means they're supposed to know he's the one that provides them with bread? We assume God can do miracles in Egypt, so of course he can make bread. Why do we know that? We know that because we have a Chumash. The Jewish people were kids. They grew up. They grew up over the course of the Chumash. They made mistakes. But because they were a baby, they had to understand how to relate to God for the first time. Now turn the page. But don't look. If I say that, you're going to look. So don't look at page 2. Kenny, you're in charge of this, okay? Don't look at page 3. Just look at page 2. I see you. I can see everybody from here. Just look at page. This is better on the Zoom because you only can see what they give you on the Zoom. But here, everybody has the hard copy. Could it be that the stages that the Jewish people go through in Egypt have something to do with the stages that a baby has to go to develop through life? So Eric Erickson was a psychologist in Berkeley, and he developed the very famous 8 stages of psychosocial development, which either brings back good memories or bad memories of high school or college or something like that. Everybody's heard of Erickson. What is Erickson's basic idea? Erickson said like this, that we develop psychologically based on our connection with others. There's a pretty very interesting religious idea that by the interaction with an other, we develop. We don't develop ourselves. We develop because we interact with an other. What Erickson suggests is that through our lifetime, we go through 8 different stages. And at each stage, there's a challenge that we need to overcome. A challenge having to do with who we are and the people around us. And if we succeed in that challenge, then we pick up emotional and psychological skills for the rest of our life. And if we don't, then we need to see somebody. And if we don't pick up what we were supposed to pick up when we were 1 year old, a one-year-old, says Eric Erickson, you're going to need to see somebody when you're 22, because you have to get through these stages to be healthy, or else you're going to be dogged by them at some point. It's not all or nothing, Baruch Hashem. But you have to accomplish this in order to be psychologically healthy to go forward. Let's look what he says. The first year of life, trust versus mistrust. That's the challenge. The first year of life is described in all the pictures of Erickson as a bottle. It's a bottle. You learn to trust or not to trust the only adults in your life, your parents. Did you ever think about that? You develop trust because you know that the parent is coming back and the parent is going to feed you. And if the parent doesn't do that, it's not something you're only going to deal with when you're a 6-month-old kid. Second year. The second year of life is the second stage, autonomy versus doubt. Feelings of shame and self-doubt. What is the second year about? What is the most important word for a kid to say in his or her second year? Parents, what's the most important word for a child to say in their twos? Why? Not why?
No.
Now, we like why. But it's frustrating. The first time the kid figures out that they can say no, it's really like a sea change. And you sound like, if you actually remember that moment with a particular child, it's like the first time they say no. They've been ever thrilled. It's like, no. They're like, what? you never said no before. No is really important. No gives them a sense of autonomy. They're somebody themselves. It's critical for a kid to say no at some point, to be able to establish a sense of self. Number 3, the third stage is 3 to 5 years, initiative versus guilt. Initiative versus guilt. What do you have to do when you're 3 to 5? You have to start doing stuff on your own. And if you're not good at it, you feel bad. You see, if you're a 2-year-old and you're not walking that well, I don't know, 2-year-olds, some are better at walking, some are not. Rarely does a kid who's 2 years old and they don't walk well say, I'm just not a good walker. I don't know. I mean, Everybody's got their strengths and weaknesses, but just walking is not my thing. No. A two-year-old knows whether they succeed or not, but doesn't have senses of initiative versus guilt. They don't in any way evaluate themselves based on how they're doing. But once you're 3 years old, you have to start doing stuff for yourself. You have to take on your own things. The sixth year to puberty, industry versus inferiority. Industry versus inferiority. At this stage, when you're from 6 years until puberty, you begin to judge yourself by other people around you as well. Am I ahead of the class? Am I back of the class? It's a very difficult time for kids. That's what I have to develop. I have to develop a good sense of self vis-a-vis others. Identity versus confusion. Wow. Identity versus confusion is adolescence. What does that mean, identity versus confusion? I always use this when I speak about a bar and a bar mitzvah. Bar and a bar mitzvah. Why did Chazal make a bar and a bar mitzvah? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Alach HaMosh Messina, why did they make a bar and a bar mitzvah at 12 and 13? It's not because the kid is an adult. It's not that kids were much bigger then or much more responsible then. Have you ever been at a bar and a bar mitzvah and just felt a little silly? Like seriously, the kid can't even see above the shulchan. Oh, today you're a man. You're not a man when you're 13 years old. I mean, a few guys are, but mostly you're not. They write your name all over the napkins and they put it in the balloons. What's the point of doing a bar mitzvah at 12 and 13? Chazal tell us, you may not be responsible for your actions until you're 20. That's a huge gap. I try not to tell that to teenagers, but there's an understanding there. We know, by the way, psychologically, Dr. Pelkovitz talks about this, that children's brains are broken. They're just not done till they're about 20, which explains a lot of things. They're just things that aren't connected to other things. When you say, are you out of your mind? It kind of, you know, I'm working on it. Why is it that we have a bar about mitzvah? Because you know what's so important to an adolescent? To know who they are. They want a sense of identity. Why are kids so clicky at that age? Why are they so into fads and things like that? Because they can't identify themselves based on who they are. They have to join into a clique. They have to join into a style. They have to do something that defines. A kid who's 6 years old isn't doing this. And even a kid who's 10 years old isn't so interested in who am I. But that's what hits an adolescence. You know what we tell a kid at their bar and bar mitzvah? You're not ready for it. But I'm just telling you, you have an identity that is so much better than anything else out there if it's being a Jew. You might not be ready to handle this for quite a few years, but I just want you to know, now that you're looking for an identity, you have an identity. That's the stage of adolescence. Early adulthood. What's the next stage? Stage number six. Early adulthood, the next challenge, intimacy versus isolation, to be able to find one person that you can connect with, to move away from the peer group. Middle age, generativity versus self-absorption. What is this stage? This is the stage when I basically move out of Westgate. Okay, I move out of Westgate. Westgate, like it's, you know, the two of you and you're a couple of kids, but you're not like involved with like society. You don't pay membership, Chas v'shalom, to the local shuls. You're just like, that's your thing. That's early adulthood. Middle age is where you begin to see, what can I give to society? How can I move beyond us? In the aging years, integrity versus despair. The challenge, they define the aging years as 65, no comment on what that is, but 65 plus is when we look and we say, have I really contributed what I want to? Have I done what, have I accomplished my goals? Have I left something for the next generation and the grandchildren, et cetera, et cetera? It is fascinating to consider the possibility that the Jewish people went through these exact eight stages when they left Egypt. Now, you know they went through stages. The first stage was Moshe Rabbeinu showing up and saying, hey, everybody, we get to be free, and they weren't ready for it. And we blame them. We're like, why wouldn't you take this get out of Egypt free? Because they're babies. And then there was a while they weren't slaves, but they hadn't left. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes and says, take this goat. And then they got out, and there was the whole Parshas Peshalach, and then they got the Torah, right? We all know this is all a bunch of stages. Turn the page to the last page. The The first year of life, trust versus mistrust. The first thing that a child needs to do is to be able to believe in something they can't see and they can hardly imagine. The first thing that happens to the Jewish people is when Moshe Rabbeinu shows up with the news of the Geula. The first thing the Jewish people are asked to do is to trust something they can hardly understand. The second year, autonomy versus doubt. The Jewish people are thrust into a situation where they need to begin to understand, I'm not a slave anymore. For the last 6 months, they weren't enslaved. They were just sitting there. Can I begin to take my own steps? It was very hard for them to know what to do with their lives, what to do about this God that was supposedly supposed to be taking them out. Third through 5 years, initiative versus guilt. The Jewish people are told at a certain point, you have to take initiative. You have to bring the korban pesach. You have to do something. Take an animal. Make kol miba asor. Take an animal on the 10th. And they're then put into a situation of industrial versus inferiority, the initial journey in the desert. Now, I know you'll tell me, wait a minute, Rabbi, you're going too fast here. Initial journey in the desert, that has nothing to do with school-age kids. Isn't that the time where you're in school and you're trying to figure out, you're looking yourself? Jewish people were alone in the desert with God. That's Parshas B'Shalach. There's nobody else in Parshas B'Shalach. That's so not true. Parshas B'Shalach opens with the Jewish people and the Egyptians. And it ends with the Jewish people and the Amalekim. And one of the things the Jewish people have to learn is that they are the class favorite. They have to learn that God will save them, that if both the Jews and the Egyptians go into the sea, God is going to let the Jews out and not the Egyptians. And when the Amalekim say, you're just like everybody else, they're not like everybody else. What the Jews had to learn after they took that initiative in Mitzrayim and they left Mitzrayim, they had to learn that God was going to take care of them in a very special way, different from the rest of the people of the world. Identity versus confusion. What do they need to be given then? An identity. They come to Matan Torah. This is who you are. But not until they go through the other stages. They don't get the Torah the second that Moshe Rabbeinu comes into Egypt. They have to grow a little bit. They have to be yearning for, who am I? It wasn't until they found themselves in the desert after all this time that they said, what is it? What are we supposed to be doing? Matan Torah. But then, after passing the first five stages, it's interesting to consider the possibility that they failed the next two. What is it that the Jew needs to do after he's given the Torah? Intimacy versus isolation. To move completely out of the peer group and to commit once and for all to one. Is that the Chet HaEgel? The Jews are then, after not completely succeeding at the Chet HaEgel, they're asked to go forward. And what do they have to do? They have to move from, it's not exactly like the desert is Westgate, but they have to move from a situation where they're just this people amongst themselves and build a country and build a land and go to war and make things for their children. Could this somehow give us insight to the two places they failed? The willingness to fully commit to a different lifestyle. The willingness to commit to a lifestyle of full productivity instead of just being out there in the desert. It's a fascinating possibility. We live in this generation of integrity versus despair. Will the Jewish people hold on till the end? Will we be able to look back at history? Now you'll tell me, I got a problem with number three. And someone's going to email me and say, I got a problem with number six. But sometimes you see a system in front of you and you say, there's something here. Somehow, in some way, does it follow exactly these things? Does everything exactly fit in? I'd love to hear what you have to say after the share. It's late. But do the Jewish people seem to follow a certain pattern? Do they seem to go from stage to stage? Do they have to learn to interact with God the way that we have to learn to interact with those around us? Absolutely. And it's hard. And we can't judge them, but we need to learn the lessons. And with this, I'll end. It could very well be that the reason why we had to go through everything in Egypt was because God wanted a real relationship with us and wanted to meet us as a people. And if that's so, then Pesach is not just about freedom, and it's not just about a Seder, but it's about a relationship with God and a recognition that he wants to have a relationship with us as a people, not just as individuals. The first, look down this list. What is the favorable outcome? Faith, adequacy, initiation, learn how things work and understand, seeing oneself as a unique and integrated person, the ability to commit. Do we have these things with God? Do we trust in God? Has he been there for us? Have he given us enough bottles that we could trust in him? All of these stages, what one learns, what one gains, is a better self. One grows. But one grows in the context of a relationship. Has HaKadosh Baruch Hu been our parent? And how many stages can we go through in our own life till we begin to think about whether or not he's going to be a father to us and he's going to be a spouse to us? All of these things are things that he wants from us. The second thing it teaches us is that while he loves us as individuals, he wants to meet us as a people. It's a very powerful message, especially at this time that we're coming back to our shuls. They were wondering whether or not it is pretty nice to daven in the backyard. Whether or not the calm and quiet that we found. I davened some of my best Shmoneh Esreis in my living room without everybody around. It was really nice. But that God not only wants a relationship with us, but he wants a relationship with us as a people. In fact, we had to go through everything we went through because he wanted to meet us as the Jewish people, not just as individuals. Pesach is a very interesting holiday because it's a family holiday. It's one that we spend alone at home, even if we're not really alone. We're home with our families. That's where the action takes place. But coming to shul the next morning, together, when it's okay, when it's the right thing to do, all coming together the next morning after our individual family experience at night, that's also what Pesach is about. Meeting God as a people. Barov Am Hadris Melech. But finally, it helps us get a little insight into the difficult times in our lives and the difficult times in the lives of our people, to the challenges that individuals face, and especially to those who don't necessarily get to see the end of the process. What did it mean for a Jew in Egypt to die before they got out? What did it mean to be a part of a people that never witnessed the Geula? Rabbi Soloveitchik, in a beautiful essay, explained that there's a good reason why at a funeral, the funeral of a parent, one says a Kaddish about the days of Mashiach come. It's a strange thing. I mean, like, I got other things to worry about. Parent passed away. We say this very strange Kaddish, the Kaddish about the Schadita, the Kaddish Baruch, who should bring, you should bring back Yerushalayim and the Mashiach. You have a child who's at the grave of a parent. A parent always dies too soon. And the child was given a text and said, you know what? Talk about Mashiach. Rabbi Soloveitchik explained beautifully that although the Jewish people, although Jewish tradition, although the Torah, although the Ribbono Shel Olam recognizes death and treats death as tragic, it also recognizes that a part of us never dies. It is said about the Jewish people that the Jewish people, the tzibor lo mate. A tzibor, the Jewish people never die. People may have died in Egypt. People may die before they see all of their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. But they don't die. Because as a tzibor, we're going to get to the finish line. and the role that each individual played and the lessons that they taught us, even if they're no longer here, are critical for us being able to get to that beautiful end of the Jewish people. These 8 stages of psychosocial development is not something that any one Jewish person did. No Jewish person is going to live from the beginning of time till the end of time. And there's so many that suffered and so many that died and so many that died in Egypt and since and so many terrible things afterwards. Where's the justice of it all? It's very hard to understand it on an individual level. But if I'm part of something greater than myself, if I'm part of the Jewish people, then I will get to the finish line. I may not have everybody with me that I would have wanted to have been there at that finish line. But we will get there to the finish line. The Jewish people that needed to be reintroduced to God as a baby, they will get to the finish line. They will not despair. They will not end their life wondering if it was all worth it, because the Jewish people will get to the finish line. The Jewish people always. So we say to a child who's looking at a funeral into the grave, we say to them, talk about Mashiach. Not because we're trying to distract you, but because we're trying to explain what just happened. Nobody lives forever. Nobody goes from the beginning of this imagined lifetime when we were babies in Egypt until we'll be old people at the time of Mashiach. But we say to the child, we say, make sense of this. Talk about the fact that the Mashiach is going to come. Talk about the fact that the Jewish people are never going to die. That Tzibur lo meis. That's ultimately what the Kaddish that we say at the grave and the Kaddish that we say for the year of mourning and the Kaddish that we say on the Yortzeit. Kaddish we say on the Yortzeit, Yehei Shmei Rabbi Mevorach. The name of God should be great. It will be great. It is going to happen. And when it happens, the sacrifices of all those who came and all those whose role was not to make it to the finish line, but just to make sure to have children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That was their contribution. They pushed it ahead. 1 generation, 2 generations. They were the ones that allowed the Jews to get to the finish line. It's a difficult Pesach. We won't always be able to have everyone who's an important part of our lives at the table. And this being the 2nd Yortzeit year for Kenny and for Meredith and for their families, you don't have everyone at the table that you'd love to be. But the promise of Pesach is that we all live on way beyond our death, not just in Shemayim, but we live on through the Jewish people. We live on through the fact that we have children, we have grandchildren, if we're blessed, and even if we're not blessed with children, we've made an impact. We were an important part. We were one of those tiny little rings that allowed this thing to get all the way to the end. May it be that we experience that soon. I think we have a little better understanding of the first 7 stages. Integrity versus despair. There are many times at this point in history where the Jewish people deserve to despair just a little bit. The holiday of Pesach, the Kaddish that we say every day in Shul, but especially on the Yortzeit, tells us that there's no reason to despair because the Jewish people will never die.